rise, please. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Thank you. Be seated, please. Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to the Idaho Supreme Court for our second day of cases from our court of interim. We are now taking up an appeal entitled Norgarden versus Hebert, brought by Jay Hebert and responded to by Kermit Hebert and Ruth Ann Norgarden. Jay Hebert is represented by Jack Mosby. Good morning.
Good morning.
And the respondent, Kermit Hebert, by Lex Finney.
Good morning.
Good morning. And respondent Ruth Ann Norgarden by James Theodore Deal. It's my understanding the respondents have split their time equally. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Very well. Are there any preliminary matters for either party or any of the parties before we begin?
None.
Very well. Mr. Mosby, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the Court, Chief Justice Bell, Justices, Counsel, I'm Jack Mosby, Attorney for Appellant K.K. Bear. This is a petition case. Ruth Ann Norgarden obtained a judgment against her brother, Clement, and her sister, Kay, for the sale of Lot 2 at co-owned piece of real property in Bowen County. District Court ordered sale based on its conclusion that great prejudice would necessarily result from any petition in kind. So the question here is, whether the district court erred by refusing to appoint referees and instead ordering partition by sale of Lot 2 based on its finding that great prejudice would necessarily result. The answer to the question is yes. Now I'll focus on three areas and explain that. First, the district court erred when it concluded as a matter of law that partitions must comply with county subdivision ordinances, whereby it found that great prejudice would necessarily result because the costs to do so, in this case, were great prejudice, and the resulting parcels from any subdivision would be of unequal value. Second, the district court made clearly erroneous findings of fact, which underlie its finding of great prejudice. And third, the district court abused its discretion in ordering sale of Lot 2 based on its finding that great prejudice would necessarily result because it was actually avoidable. So the district court therefore lacked discretion. The district court does have discretion to order sale, but under the Partition Act, that discretion is limited. It can only be exercised upon a proper finding that great prejudice will necessarily result from any partition in kind. So as to what constitutes great prejudice, it's a matter of first impression for this court to decide whether a partition in kind can only be done in compliance with county subdivision ordinances, and if so, whether great prejudice necessarily results if the resulting parcels from such a partition would not comply as adjusted with those ordinances. And the other side of that question is whether the costs to bring those parcels into compliance constitute great prejudice. The legislative intent implied by the language is that this is a high standard. It speaks to great prejudice, not some prejudice, not great financial prejudice. And the language necessarily indicates that if that prejudice can be avoided, the standard is not met, and therefore the district court must appoint the referees. But that's not the end of it. Once the referees give a report, the district court can either accept it, or set it aside, order a new one, modify it, or even appoint new referees. But while the statute doesn't say this expressly, the district court could, upon receiving a referee's report, then find that great prejudice would necessarily result from all the options of referees reported, and then order a partition by sale. That's what they requested in their closing brief at trial, but the court didn't do that. Even though three referees offered to accept appointment, a land use planner, Scott Brown, a land surveyor, Alan Kubera, and a real estate broker, Cindy Bond. They all testified at trial as to their familiarity with Lot 2, and their testimony showed that the Lot 2 could be divided under Barber County Code into parcels of equal value, which were marketable and saleable.
To what degree does the financial ability of at least two of the three siblings to pay for that service enter into the equation of great prejudice?
Thank you, Anna. I think that's a critical question here to decide. Where is the rational calculus for when costs can equal great prejudice? And there being no identical case authority on this subject, I think we have to look at the language of the statute. This is a high standard. If the prejudice can be avoided, meaning if there's any way to avoid great prejudice, and in this case, costs were the basis for great prejudice, it can be avoided if someone can pay it. And this is a matter of equity. So in the district court doing equity, if, say, for example, can't pay all the costs, then she could equitably obtain a larger portion of Lot 2 from the partition or from the proceeds coming out of the partition if it was sold if she paid those costs down herself. So to the question, I don't know why I would say where that in that calculus two parties saying they can't afford it comes in.
But counsel, we didn't have any party saying they could pay for all of the costs to make these lots compliant with zoning and therefore marketable. So how does that factor into it when there's no affirmative evidence to suggest any of the three parties can pay these costs that are required to make this property marketable?
Thank you. And I think the answer to your question is that, once again, we're referring to a high standard. We didn't know what all the costs would be at trial. We didn't know what all the costs would be to set up at it. We knew it would cost money to add water or sewer, and there was identified costs in addition to adding those services. There was about $21,000 that the judge found in the findings of fact for the costs of subdivision, plus the additional cost of adding sewer and water to the property. That was what was determined to be great prejudice. But we didn't know what that would actually cost. All we knew was that there was some cost identified, and Kay identified that she did have the means, while she didn't have the means at one time.
Well, hold on. When I read the transcript, she testified she had the means to pay the taxes. I don't see any testimony that indicates she had the means to pay the expenses to make the property marketable so that it were compliant with the zoning ordinance.
I believe her testimony was that she could contribute to those costs. This is a cross-examination from Mr. Finney, to which she responded that she could contribute to those costs.
Right, and then my recollection of the testimony is Mr. Finney followed up and started detailing some costs, and she said, well, I guess my hope is I would get my piece, and they would get their two pieces, and then everybody, the way I read her testimony was, then everybody's responsible for making their own property compliant.
I agree that's the direction of what she hoped, and that's what she did testify to, but that doesn't contradict her testimony that she does have means, and she could pay those costs, so...
You said contribute to. That's different than I can pay for the costs.
And the reason why there was that distinction, I think, is because we didn't know what those costs would be. She can't testify she's going to pay the whole bill without knowing what the bill is.
So let me ask you about that, because as I read the trial transcript, you had an expert, a land planner. So why couldn't he estimate those costs for you in advance of trial?
The burden at the trial stage was not to show here is what we can do. The burden was to prove that it can be done, and then the judge will quote referees, and that's what Kay was seeking at trial. The burden doesn't, as I know was argued in the response briefing, that they have to prove it can be done without great prejudice. I think that was shown at trial. But the burden is on the party seeking sale to prove that it cannot be done without great prejudice.
And so now I'm going to circle back to the very beginning, to the Chief Justice's question. So we have a district court that says this is going to take $21,000 at least, to make these properties compliant, these two, Kay and Ruth Ann, or sorry, Kermit and Ruth Ann, are saying we don't have the money to pay for it. Kay doesn't say she can pay for it. At best, she says, I can contribute. And so help me understand how the district court erred in finding this is great prejudice. It requires this much money. Nobody can pay it, all of it. This is great prejudice.
The district court did not bother to give referees the opportunity to say, here's the whole cost bill of what it would cost. We know that the taxes were about $21,000 of earners, and we know that Kay said that she could pay those. We know that the costs for subdivision were about the same, and Kay said she could contribute to those as well. If Kay can pay $21,000 in taxes, logic would dictate she can pay $21,000 for the cost of subdivision. But if she can also contribute to those costs, the issue is that the district court found that there was no evidence to suggest that the parties had the means to subdivide. But Kay testified that she did have means.
But the judge said that all three parties, including Kay, are septuagenarians of very limited financial means. That's a finding of fact by the judge that hasn't been contradicted, has it?
I agree. I think that has not been contradicted. However, we're referring to a high standard here. The evidence did not show that Kay cannot pay those costs.
What evidence showed that she could?
Her testimony that she had inherited money from, that she had inherited funds. So while the circumstantial evidence of the taxes being in arrears or the mortgages being in default.
How do you square that with the determination that she had very limited means? And that's a fact that is part of the record now.
It is, but I don't understand the question.
So how does Kay's suggestion that she came into this largesse through inheritance and the judge's determination that she was of very limited means?
Well, I think that the determination that she was of very limited means, it simply doesn't have, there was no investigation into what means she actually had at trial.
Except you had extensive testimony that at multiple points she had failed to keep the taxes up on the property, she couldn't afford to make improvements to the property, she still is living in a place where, you know, it's not connected to regular water, it's not connected to sewer, you've got a septic field that leaches periodically into the ground. I mean, all of the evidence that the district court cites suggests she doesn't have the means to pay $21,000 in back taxes plus $20,000 for the improvements or, you know, whatnot to make this compliant. And so that's where I'm struggling with where did the district court err based on the evidence it had before it?
There's two explanations for those circumstances as to she at one time was allowing the mortgages to go into default or the taxes not to be paid. She gave that trial in her testimony when she explained that she wasn't going to be making contributions to the property with the expectation that her siblings were going to reap the benefit. She would get no reward for having done all that extra work. She might have had a misunderstanding of the equitable powers of the court, but that was her reasoning. But the other side of that is that while at one time she may have lacked the means, it does not contradict the fact that she inherited means later. We do know the fact that as, I believe it was Kermit's, his motion for reconsideration, where he indicated Kay has paid taxes on lot 2 as required in the court's motion for, or order granting motion for stay, and she's also posted a supersedious bond over $40,000. So she definitely had means.
Okay, so did she post the $40,000 or did she go get a bond? For $40,000.
She posted a cash bond. A cash bond with the clerk.
So she posted the entire $40,000 herself.
I think it was $41,900-something. So, there being some evidence, there is not no evidence, as the court found, that the parties had means to subdivide. And so, while, yes, there may be a possibility of great prejudice, or even a likelihood, that is not a standard that the statute reflects. It is great prejudice this will necessarily result, meaning it cannot be avoided.
I don't understand your argument there. Great prejudice doesn't mean impossibility. And I think you're equating the two. We trust our judges with all kinds of evidentiary standards. Substantial evidence, beyond a reasonable doubt evidence, clear and convincing evidence. The rules of evidence talk about unfair prejudice. The statute doesn't obviously define great prejudice, but isn't great the type of adjective that we can trust judges to interpret? And it doesn't, certainly it doesn't mean impossible.
I agree, Justice Miller. It doesn't mean impossible. But the impossibility component doesn't come from great prejudice relative to the statute. It comes from necessarily. So there's two keys to this. The prejudice must be great, and it must be unavoidable. If there's any way to avoid it, then what I'm arguing is that there were methods to avoid great prejudice, and that those were not investigated further. But because they couldn't be avoided, the district court lacked discretion to order sale. It must be necessarily. So while it's not impossible to divide lot two, to answer your question, great prejudice from a partition of lot two would not necessarily result from a partition of lot two.
As we look at the trial court's findings of fact and the deference, the degree of deference she's properly owed here, does it change anything that the judge in this case actually took the trouble to walk the property, to see it firsthand, do a site visit? I realize there's no special thing about that, but it would seem to me the fact that the judge actually had feet on the ground and saw this would cause us to perhaps be a little more inclined to defer to what she saw and what she thought.
Yeah, I believe it goes toward the judge's finding the fact that the value of lot two is in the waterfront. But I believe that came from the testimony we heard at trial. We heard that the waterfront of the property was the essence of lot two. That was the language used. So I believe it lends more credibility to that being where the large component of the value of lot two is located.
Do you disagree with that finding?
I do not. But I don't believe that finding demonstrates that any division of lot two would necessarily result in great prejudice to the owners. So the issue here is that the district court, in finding great prejudice, she concluded as a matter of law that great prejudice, that a partition must comply with county subdivision ordinances. She didn't just consider it as a factor the way that the respondents argue. And I think that's important. Lot 2, if it can be subdivided, that would indicate that great prejudice can be avoided. I think the testimony of trial from the experts was that it can be. As the judge only thought it was the costs that were prejudicial.
I guess I'm struggling with how great prejudice doesn't result when you partition a property and give two unmarketable parcels to people and say, well, now it's on you, you're stuck with it, you better fix it or else you're not going to be able to sell it. I'm struggling with why isn't that prejudicial?
I believe that there are a few components to that consideration. First of all, lot two is already non-conforming. So partitioning into already non-conforming but it's still non-conforming lots doesn't change all that much of that equation for these owners. So the question is not whether the parcels will be buildable later on. The question is whether they will be valuable to the owners later on, and whether they can put them to that use. The Cox versus Cox case in dicta speaks to land use or land zoning ordinances prohibiting a division of that property. In this case, the zoning do not prohibit it. It just costs some money to make it happen. So that's what the issue arises. Where is the calculus? You have a $90 million piece of property and then it costs $21,000 plus adding a sewer or some other services to the property. There has to be some rational relation to the value of the actual property as a whole, and there's just no precedent on which district courts can rely on making that determination.
Right, but if it's not marketable because it's not conforming, doesn't that impact the value of those parcels, adversely impact the value of those parcels?
I believe it would. But in this case, there's testimony that shows that it can be divided into marketable and saleable parcels of equal value. That comes from Scott Brown's testimony and from Cindy Bond indicating that divided parcels of lot 2 would be valuable. That was presupposed. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, I mean, Mr. Brown's testimony is that he gives a percentage likelihood that the county would approve it. Isn't that a gamble? I mean, as the district court is weighing all of this, I'm still struggling to see where the district court erred in saying a percentage likelihood that these will be made marketable and conforming. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to go with the testimony that we have an offer of $2 million for the entire parcel, and I'm going to hold that great prejudice will result if I put my money on this gamble and give these people these parcels that the county may or may not approve the minor land division. So help me understand again, how did the district court err when it had all of that evidence in making that determination?
The error comes from the statutory language that great prejudice must necessarily result. It can't be avoided. And we had testimony that there were ways to do it, and the district court only considered one mechanism, a minor land division of three equal parcels north to south, one for each owner. But Indian equity is not so limited, and there were options under Bonner County Code to divide lot 2 in a way that was equitable and still marketable and saleable. So the
other finding was that, as I understood it, it says, first, none of the options discussed at trial for subdividing lot 2 would result in three parcels of equal value due to the greater desirability of the waterfront parcel. I mean, why isn't that enough just to end it all, I mean, in the entire discussion? If you divide it, you're not going to create three parcels that are equal.
There's a few reasons. First of all, partitions in Idaho do not have to be equal in order to be equitable. Unequal contributions to the property can justify an unequal split. Inequalities or inequities can be resolved with a compensatory adjustment. Dividing into three parcels was not the only equitable mechanism that the court had available to it. For example, Scott Brown testified as to dividing into three parcels with a common water frontage tract, allowing all three parcels to each owner to fully enjoy the entire value of lot 2. So in that way, it doesn't necessarily have to be equal, but even if it did have to be equal, it can still be done so that the value is still provided as a benefit to all the parcels for all the owners. States with similar statutory language to Idaho determined that great prejudice exists when the partition would destroy the parcel's usefulness to the owners or would materially and substantially diminish those other parcels' value as compared to the value of the whole parcel. And those cases which are cited in the appellant's brief will speak to very clear cases of imperious necessity. I think that's the rule this court should adopt. That great prejudice is a high standard, and in the context of land use and subdivision ordinances, great prejudice only necessarily results when the parcel cannot comply. But that's not the case here. Equal great prejudice, then the result, as we have seen, is going to be that the burden will shift from the party seeking sale to the party seeking partition in kind. The burden will shift from proving that the partition cannot be had without great prejudice to proving that it can be done without great prejudice. That's what Kermit has argued in his briefing. But that's not the way the statute reads. The issue is that this is a high standard, and it must be unavoidable. If it can be avoided, the court lacks discretion. And just as a final note, before I reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, in regard to attorney's fees, I did misstate in a reply briefing that there is no statutory basis for a waiver of attorney's fees. I would correct that. There is no right to statutory attorney's fees under the partition statute. The court has discretion, but the district court did not exercise that discretion. This is a good faith appeal. It's based on genuine issues of law. Matters of first impression, this court has not decided that would reverse the district court's decision, and no matter which way it goes, it is going to result in a court precedent that will guide district courts as to how to harmonize the partition statute with land use and subdivision ordinances. So attorney's fees should not be awarded to any party. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Neal? Here's the court, justices, counsel. My name is Ted Deal. It's James Theodore, but I go by Ted. And I'm representing Ruth Ann Milgarden. And I've obviously listened to the testimony so far, or the comments by the court. And so I'm going to switch kind of the direction I was headed with my argument. I was going to go into the facts, but it's apparent that you guys have read the transcript carefully, and so I'm going to avoid that. In looking at appellant's primary focus of their brief, they're really asking this court to come up with a different standard than what currently exists under our partition statute. The partition statute does reference this great prejudice. They're asking you to come up with a more rigid standard or, to try to pin this down. And I think the court needs to resist that urge to go that direction. The part of one of the briefs, they're asking that what they would like to see is that the court adopt a rule or definition for great prejudice such that it would exist only where there is no way to divide property without destroying its usefulness. And if the court went that direction, then the next case that came along, you'd have to come up with what does that mean without destroying its usefulness.
Before you go too far down the statutory analysis road, let's back up for just a second to the standard of review. If you look at the, I guess it would be Pandrea case, Pandrea versus Barrett, did the court act erroneously upon the facts presented? What exactly is that standard for us? Is it a discretionary standard such that we're reviewing a discretionary call, or is it more of a de novo standard?
My understanding of it, Your Honor, is that it's a discretionary standard. I think that the statute is clearly giving the discretion to the trial court to decide what's great prejudice and what's not. And I think that it is a discretionary standard. And I think that that's the review that you have to make. And I think the finding in Wilson versus Tavi, if I can find that here. Your role here is not to relay the evidence, which I think is what appellants are asking you to do, but I think your role is not to relay the evidence, but to defer to the trial court's decision as to whether they have considered all the appropriate factors associated with a given parcel of property. And to coming up with a rigid definition for what that means, I don't think you can do that when you're dealing with real estate. Now, obviously, the factors associated with 400 acres of farmland are significantly different than the factors associated with something like what we have here, which is waterfront property, or commercial property, or view property. All of the factors that go into those analyses are going to be different depending on the type of property you're dealing with. And coming up with a rigid standard, like the appellants are asking you to do, It takes away from what trial court's role is, which is to go out, hear the testimony, in this case, take a view, take a look at the property. And I think it was apparent to Judge Buchanan when she went out to look that the northwest portion of this property, which is where the family home is the essence of that piece of property. And I think it was obvious to the judge when she viewed the property that,
that's the whole part of the property that anyone would want, and dividing it up into any manner and leaving that piece with Cake there and not allowing Ruth Ann, for instance, to obtain the benefit of that parcel. There was no way to make an equitable division of that property to make it fair for all these three owners. And I think the judge became convinced of that, and I think that's why she ruled the way she did. And back to the cost issue.
Before we get to the cost, it would seem to me, although not stated this way, implicit in the court's conclusions, was that she found that the whole of the property was basically greater than the sum of its parts. It was partitioned.
I agree with that.
Counsel is suggesting that's too simplistic, that we can't just assume that based upon the evidence in the record, but we should have allowed three referees an opportunity to see if they could make it work. What was the rush that kept the court from allowing the three referees from taking a look at this and getting some actual maps in front of her that showed how the property might be divided before concluding that it was just great prejudice?
I'm not sure from the record that you can pick that up, but I think what the court was doing was, no matter what happened with the division of this property, Kaker stated in court, the only piece of property that she wanted is the northwest portion, which was the part of the property that was described by Dr. Cubbage as being the essence of the property. So no matter what type of division was going to happen here, that's the piece that Ruth or Kay wanted, and that's also the piece that Ruth Ann said that she would prefer to have if this property were actually physically capable of being split. And as far as, you know, why the court chose not to appoint referees, you know, I can't speak to that because she didn't indicate that in her findings. But, you know, appointing three referees, you know, there's certainly going to be cost associated with doing that. They're not going to do that for free. And that has not been calculated into the costs that were estimated as part of the judge's determination.
This case in some ways bears resemblance to what in water law we refer to as the futile call rule, where you can't call for water if the water is not going to be deliverable. Here it feels like the court applied a futility standard and felt like the referees aren't going to be able to find anything. She made the decision that it was going to be impossible for them to come up with something. Am I looking at this correctly?
I think you are looking at it correctly, and I think that I think there are a number of factors that went into that. You know, you can't really see this from the maps that are associated with this property, but the property is, you know, it's long and narrow, and it slopes from the back of the property down to the waterfront, so from south, the southern portion down to the north on the water. And it also slopes west to east. And once you get about halfway down across the width, as Kermit testified, this is a solid piece of rock that's out there. And the water flows downhill from west to east. Its surface is there. It's moist all year round. That's why when the substandard septic system isn't working, it leaches out onto the surface of that property. And I think that the judge saw that when he walked the property. She saw it, I saw it, and I think that that's why she made the determination that there's no way to physically divide this and make it equitable.
Well, and doesn't the statute make her the gatekeeper? I mean, I guess when I look at the statute, I'm not sure that the referees have any role in terms of whether to partition. Their role is how we're going to partition.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I, you know, the Kermit Cabrera and even the land use planners, although I don't believe, well, Scott Brown certainly never went and visited the property, he never saw it, so he wasn't able to, you know, give a good description of what he would do out there as a land planner. Jeremy Grimm, he was familiar with the property, he didn't actually go out and walk it either. So neither of those planners had actually set foot on the property. But Jeremy Grimm was at least familiar with its location. After the parents died, Kay and her then husband Doug Actually, we're trying to figure out a way to split the property even back in the early 90s, when Marty was still alive, and it had been still four of us. They weren't able to come up with any game plan that was going to work. And I think there were efforts continually throughout the years to try to figure out a way to split this up, and they could never come up with anything. And Ruth Ann finally was ready to benefit from the ownership, and so she went ahead and demanded that something happen. They purchased her interest or they sell the property. 2 years later, she had to file a partition action. And Kermit agrees that it can't be split. Kermit's the one that, you know, is most familiar with the topography, the geology, and he has 50 years of sewer experience. He knows that there's no way to do a conventional drain field out there, so you're going to have some kind of an engineered system, which is $50,000, $60,000 just for that. In addition to hiring referees, and you know, I think the price tag on this is probably closer to $100,000 to get this thing compliant, if at all. And I think the judge was aware of that, and I think she made the right determination that there's no way to physically split this and make it equitable.
What about the argument in terms of the Fontenot code, right? The code that applied here, and whether that was an improper legal finding that, as far as the restrictions, they shouldn't have applied here or shouldn't have been, I guess, the argument was made by appellant that you say it's just was a factor, and appellant saying that was a finding that was inappropriate or erroneous. Can you address that point?
You know, I believe that, I think the court looked at all the appropriate factors there. You know, I think the court looked at the quantity of the land, the quality of the land, the zoning issues, the cost of compliance with zoning, as well as the financial ability of these parties to contribute. I think the court looked at all of those factors. The minor land division is the most cost-effective, but a minor land division, it has its problems with regard to this piece of property. You know, it's got that 3-to-1 width-depth ratio. It's got, this piece of property is bisected by a county road, and under the minor land division, you know, any resulting parcel can't be bisected by a county road. So that's problematic right off the get-go. And the 3-to-1 depth-to-width ratio, you know, the court and everybody agrees that the real value to this property, one is that northwest elevated portion, but, you know, it's waterfront. And that's where the value comes in. And to split this, you know, under the minor land division, without sewer and water, you're limited to 2.5 acres.
So, counsel, can you address the appellant's argument that judicial partition will trump the land ordinances, that court shouldn't have taken those into account at all because at the end of the day it has the power to overwrite those?
I think that the court can order partition, but those lots that are created by judicial partition are non-conforming. And to go in and try to get a building permit and do anything with it, then you're back to dealing with the county. And so I think what you have is an unmarketable, you know, spirit of property that you can't do anything with. And so the value, obviously, is considerably less. If you can't build anything on it, then what it would be without. And I've seen that before, where the court has ordered partition, and then you have a parcel of property that is unbuildable because you can't get a building permit. And, there are variances that are granted. There's an administrative variance by the planning director, but it has, you can only vary about 30% of what the rules are. Otherwise, you've got to go through the whole public hearing, you bring in the neighbors, and all of a sudden, you may or may not be able to build. And it clearly impacts, you know, the value of those houses.
And what about counsel's argument that it's non-conforming as is?
I think the only reason, you know, the width to depth ratio, if you're 275 feet wide and 800 feet long, I think you're compliant with the depth with the one parcel. The one item that is probably makes it non-compliant is that it's bisected by a county road. But on the other hand, this Lutton Lake lots, I think, was plotted in the 50s, 40s, something like that. It was long before these rules were in place. So it's a grandfathered conforming law at this point, so you wouldn't have any problem with what you currently have. But to go out and split it, you're back into the Bonner County Code and compliance.
What about council's suggestion for a hybrid or exotic type partition that would allow for a common area along the shoreline and then three recessed divided lots?
I think that that, you know, I mean, obviously that is one of the options that would be potentially available. But again, if you were to do, make a common lot along the waterfront, and maybe three lots in the back, might be able to comply with the width-to-depth ratios. But on the other hand, what happens with, because it would either be a conservation subdivision or a planned unit development or something like that, but all of a sudden that triggers much higher, greater scrutiny and more requirements. It would require fire access roads into all the lots. So you're going to lose a good portion of that property. You have to deal with stormwater. You have to deal with safety. All of a sudden, it becomes a fairly major development, and the cost of doing that is going to be probably two or three times what it would be to comply with the minor land division. And these parties, certainly my client, has no ability to contribute. Kermit has indicated he has no ability to contribute. So the burden would fall on Kay completely, and I don't believe that she has the ability to satisfy those requirements.
Was there evidence in the record as to what that type of arrangement would do to the overall value of the parcels?
I don't recall anybody necessarily testifying to that. Cindy Bond would have been the one that probably would have had an opinion, and I don't believe that that question was asked of her. I guess back to, I think what the appellant was really asking me to do was come up with a different standard. And quite frankly, I think our standard that we have in place works. I think it's, the great prejudice, what's happening is you're leaving that decision up to the trial court, who's in the proper position, but whatever the various factors are on a given piece of property. Looking at, 6501 and the limited number of cases that have been appealed leads me to believe that the system that we currently have in place works pretty well, because otherwise there'd be significantly more appeals than there have been. So I would ask or suggest that this court resist coming up with any different standard, leave great prejudice in place, let the trial court do its job, which I think it did here, and I think that it set forth its findings and conclusions, I think, pretty well. And I don't think that there is any clear error, and I think the appellants are asking you just to re-weigh the evidence and side with it and throw it back to the court. So, any other questions?
There's none. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Finney, it appears you have 13 minutes left.
Thank you. May it please the court, thank you for the opportunity to appear here in Coeur d'Alene and argue this case. I appreciate that. Now, I'd first like to start by identifying little information that's contained in the appellant's brief, which really gives what Kay's legal position is in this case, and I don't believe it's a legal position supported in fact or law, but it's a very honorable position, and it's at the bottom of page 1, and it says Kay opposed the partition by sale because, 1, she lives on the property, and 2, it represents her parents' legacy, which Kay hopes to preserve for the next generation of family. I think that's the crux of Kay's case, is not that the property could be divided fairly into three parts, but she oftentimes, and even her attorney, refers to the home, which is owned by all three parties, as Kay's home. Kay has enjoyed the benefit of living in the home. Kay and Ruth Ann had both resided on the property, as evident from the record, and the two became unable to live next to each other, so one left, and that was Ruth Ann. Ruth Ann's occupation of property was in some modular homes or trailer houses that are basically, they're total junk. They just need to be removed. There's windfalls on them. They actually might make it harder to market the property, but when you consider the current times and this individual piece of property, which was platted in 1909, this is a very unique property. It only has under 300 feet in width, but it has a point that comes out, so there's close to 300 feet of frontage. Now, the court referred to the northeast portion of the property in the amended and corrected judgments, but it was actually the northwest. And on the northwest is the point. And not all waterfront is created equal. And where my client, and I believe Mr. Deal's client, and also the plaintiff, excuse me, Kay, all want that property in the north and west is because it also, not only does it abut Lake Pend'Oreille, when you walk the property, it's private. When you're in that location, although you're only on 5 acres and there are neighbors to the east, neighbors to the west, it's elevated above the others, it's private, it has a great view, it's a rock face, and it extends deep into the water. Some waterfront property, my mother has a waterfront property, well, from November until April or May, there is no water frontage. The lake recedes. This actually maintains access right to the lake, that essence of the property.
Counsel, attached to your brief is an Exhibit 1, which is a map of the property. Was that admitted at trial?
No, Your Honor. Excuse me.
Is there a map like Exhibit 1 that was admitted at trial that we can rely upon as part of the record?
I believe Defendant's Exhibit 1511.
Thank you.
And that is also attached. So I wanted to... It's really, you can tell where the point is, and there was another exhibit admitted at trial, I believe, that plaintiff's expert, Mr. Brown, had an exhibit. Plaintiff's expert witness was apparently at some point under the impression that the state owned that entire point. I don't have the exhibit right in front of me, but in any event, that leads to the next analysis, and here, I don't think this is a matter of first impression, because the cases of Pend'Oreille and Cox have both addressed the issue, and have set forth the standard, and the standard of review that I'm suggesting is as set forth in Hull versus Geisler, and that would be the review of a trial court's decision after a court trial is limited to ascertaining whether the evidence supports the findings of fact and whether the findings of fact support the conclusion of law. That standard somewhat tightened up by the statement in Pend'Oreille versus Baird of did the court act erroneously upon the facts presented? And in the Cox case, my dad was the appellant, Gary Finney. He thought this referee argument was a great argument, and my recollection is that the referees didn't apply according to the court because the trial court chose not to use that option. So in this case, again, looking at this unique piece of property in a unique area, there it borders Lake Pend'Oreille on the south, it abuts federal land on the Hope Peninsula. The Hope Peninsula has a major problem with septic. There is not a good, and Kermit Cabrera has extensive knowledge, operating systems here. It's basically rock. And so when you consider there are no services available for sewer or for water, that is very relevant because it makes this parcel divided into two pieces at most currently under the current. And just because there could be a variance should not be any part of the analysis except for what the court considers. And what the evidence tended to establish is that there's a strong possibility that the property cannot be divided into three equal pieces.
Are these sewage problems and water flow problems that you've discussed, is that, are they unique to Lot 2, or do all of the lots that are adjacent and nearby have similar challenges?
I think what Mr. Kermit Cabarrus told me and testified to, it applies to the entire peninsula. The peninsula is basically a solid mound that doesn't percolate, and there are
it's all built on a rock.
Exactly. It just, but yet, even in North Idaho, on a dry, rocky area, this parcel has water seeping out on the eastern, southeastern area that makes some of the area rendered useless. Also, another thing you can tell, especially from the exhibits, is that Judge Buchanan saw it. You have this beautiful private location on the northwest, and on the northeast, there's a 40-foot easement bordering it, which several, and it's a 40-foot strip that several people have access down. And then just adjacent to that, there's a kind of an eyesore A-frame type cabin. So it would be much, the judge asked who owns the A-frame when you're there, it would be much less desirable to be on that east portion than up on the Eagle's Nest, as I refer to it, with the deep water, which has large trout, potential for wintertime access to the water. The doctor, Cutledge, who is familiar with the property, he described it to his attorney as the essence of the property, and I believe his offer of $2 million, which was not after testing market, is probably low. I have a feeling this property could go, as my client thought, $3 to $5 million easily. So anyways, given the factors in the case, the court did not act erroneously upon the facts presented. The court made a well-reasoned decision after allowing ample opportunity for all the explanation needed from all the parties after coming out viewing the property, and we don't think there's any abuse of discretion here, but in fact that the judge made a reasonable, well-reasoned decision. Now, as far as whether Kay did or didn't testify about she could pay the money to have the property, so to speak, divided, my recollection, my brief on page 9 indicate that Kay testified she could contribute to the expenses of subdivision of the property because she inherited some money. The quantitative fact of the amount was given, and I believe I asked Kay where the money was going to come from to go forward with the replat, if that was even possible, and Kay answered, I can't answer that because I don't exactly know what all would have to be done. I think that's really where we ended up with this trial, is at best, speculatively, you could potentially divide the property, most likely into two, and not into three, and you can't. And I think it's also similar to the Cox case in that the house has one barn, one house. In this case, there's one house, one point, one waste area, no sewer service, no water service, and it really makes a lot of sense to divide the property, or excuse me, to sell the property, so that all the parties can share equally in what is theirs. They're both, if the property were divided, all parties, Kermit really doesn't want any of it, he'd like to have sold. And Kay would like the Eagle's Nest, and we'd then take that too if it were to be divided. Both want the best part. It's by far the most valuable. And I think that what we have here is a case that basically Kay's just asking this court to second guess. I don't think there's any authority for de novo review. I don't read the statute that way. De novo is a unique situation, a trial review, and I don't think that's where we're at. I think that given the factors in Idaho, there is adequate case law, adequate definition. This is going to be a more common type of case, given the later changes that we've experienced
for real estate
and real estate markets and people wanting to move into Bonner County, Idaho. And so I think Kay has just asked the court to second guess Judge Buchanan.
I don't understand that point. Why is it that we're going to see more of these cases?
Because people would like to live in Bonner County. And so if you only have so many pieces of property, I think that people want to divide their properties and sell them. And that's my thought. Maybe we won't see more partition cases, but I think we'll see more partition cases, more boundary line cases.
Is that because of the change in the county ordinances, or just because of the increasing population, or just because people are getting older?
I think some of each, mainly it's because San Juan, Idaho, and Bonner County is a very desirable place to live because we have things like the lake, the mountain, Walmart, all night stores. It's not, you can buy what you like, it's a recreational paradise, and just driving down here today, you used to come from San Juan and it got busy when you got to Hayden. Well, now, it's relieving to get out of Sangamon and down to Hayden. It's itself obvious to me. And I see another time. Thank you very much.
I appreciate it. Madam Clerk, how much time is left for you, Bill?
6 minutes, John.
Thank you, Chosen.
Thank you, Chosen.
Counsel, if I could ask you a question real quick so I don't interrupt your train of thought. In his concluding remarks, counsel referenced a quote from your client at the trial about inheriting some money. And I was just wondering if you could clarify your client's testimony there. Was she referring to money that she had previously inherited or the money that she stood to receive but it hadn't yet been allocated to her?
My understanding is that she had already received that money from the death of her son, Brian, because he had died some years before.
Okay, thank you.
The statute is read in such a way that if the great prejudice cannot be avoided, then that's the threshold that the judge must cross before it can then order sale. It's a critical threshold that the district court impliedly acknowledged in its finding in its conclusions of law, rather, that had to be decided before it could then order sale.
And so, counsel, when you talk about the necessarily language, are you getting that from 6-508, or where are you coming up with the necessarily language you keep referring to?
Justice, I believe I referred to, I found that language in the persuasive authorities I cited using the same statutory language, but the proper language of Idaho statutes is cannot. Idaho Code 6-501 states that for sale of such property or thereof, it appears that the partition cannot be made without great prejudice.
Okay.
So that's the proper language, but it's still absolute. And the idea here is that the great prejudice must be unavoidable. And the district court found two grounds for great prejudice: costs of subdivision and the quality of the resulting parcels from subdivision. It did not find that the resulting parcels would not comply with Bonner County Code. That was not its finding. So all this argument that it would not be possible is second-guessing the trial court's findings of fact. Its findings would not even be difficult. There would be hurdles from the various issues of Bonner County Code, but not that it was impossible, not that it couldn't be done. Great prejudice was based on costs of subdivision. And as I've indicated from his testimony, I believe that's a clearly erroneous finding of fact, because there is in fact some evidence to suggest that the parties had the means, and the district court therefore was required to give Kay the opportunity to remedy that prejudice by hiring the referees to recommend an equitable partition and say, here's what it costs. And as I said at the outset, if at that point it can't be done,
But that's not how 6-512 reads, is it? It's, if the court determines it can be done, then it appoints the referees.
I don't agree with it entirely. I agree that it doesn't state that if the referees are appointed, that they necessarily must partition in kind. I don't believe the statute reads that way. However, 6-512, the referees will be appointed if the court finds that it can be done. However, that is not saying that it absolutely can be done without great prejudice. The issue is, can it be done? Yes. But if it turns out that all of the options that were identified as potential methods to do it without great prejudice, if something is later found, such as the cost to subdivide, turn out to be too much for K to afford in this case, then at that point great prejudice would become apparent. But we didn't know the cost at trial. We didn't have all the costs it would take to subdivide, so there was no ability to make that assessment. And the problem here is that this is a co-owner's property, and it is Kay's own. That's where she lives. She's lived there for 20 years, or 25 years. So it should be a very high standard required. And I believe the word that you used, Justice Brody, was that the judge is a gatekeeper. That the judge must find that it is not possible to avoid great prejudice. That's the high standard before it forces an owner out of their property.
And so what do we make of the fact that Kay is actually living in a house that's owned by all three of these siblings? She's living there, but it's not her house. It's everybody's house.
I agree it's everyone's house, and I think that the law speaks to the right to rents for if there is someone owning that is ousting the others, and the judge has a okay to pay those rents for the time being. But at trial, I believe it comes to reimbursement, and I believe Kermit testified that there was some understanding that whoever was in the house would be paying for its maintenance, and that was just the agreement the siblings had. But I think that's determinative of whether someone actually gets to have a high standard for whether they get to keep a piece of the property where their home is. We really don't just want money. This is all about money for them. If they can get money and Kay can have a piece of lot 2 to live on, that's doing equity. And in doing equity, the district court was not limited to only three parcels, one for each owner. 6-501 expressly states that the judge can sell any part of the property. So let's cut off a little piece for Kay. They don't have to be conforming, because to Kay that's not the issue. The issue is that she gets to keep her house. And a large piece that can then be used with the 40-foot strip, which is an available means to the parties, although the court couldn't order partition of it, but it's a means available to the parties to adjust the boundary line in compliance with county code.
Counsel, to your comments about this just being about money, it's easy to say that things shouldn't be just about money when you have plenty of it. But when you don't have enough to pay your bills and pay your taxes, the property is in danger of being foreclosed on or being lost in a tax sale, then suddenly money is important. Aren't those all possibilities if the status quo is retained without changes?
Justin, did I say that out of time to answer?
You may.
Thank you. I believe that the parties' financial means are properly a factor that the district court could consider in making this determination of great prejudice. I believe that is proper. But in this case, the issue is whether they would receive that value, meaning money, from the property. And I believe the evidence shows that money could be retained from the property, whether it was partitioned in kind or partitioned as sale. I believe that the family could have still obtain that value from even a partition kind of lot 2. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Counsel Pucci. Thank you. This matter's under advisement. We will now render a decision. We'll recess about 10 minutes.
All rise, please.